This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. Health authorities are reassuring Australians about the safety of COVID vaccines following the death of a 52-year-old woman who'd received the AstraZeneca drug. She died after developing a blood clot. Doctors say the condition's rare. This is the second death in more than 3.6 million doses of vaccine being given in Australia. Medicos say they have more information on how to diagnose and treat it, but they want people to be aware of possible symptoms. With more, here's Jade McMillan.
In its weekly safety report on COVID-19 vaccines, the National Medical Regulator revealed sad news: the death of a 52-year-old woman from New South Wales who developed a rare blood clot in the brain, likely to be linked to the AstraZeneca shot. Associate Professor Santrain Pasricha is a haematologist and a division head at the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute of Medical Research.
I think it's understandable that people are nervous when they hear this news. But what's important to remember is, of course, that COVID-19 is a horrific infection and that the condition remains rare, and there are ways that we can diagnose and treat it.
There have now been two deaths in Australia believed to be linked to the AstraZeneca vaccine. But Santrain Pasricha says there has also been an extraordinary amount of progress over the past few months when it comes to diagnosing and treating blood clotting cases.
Patients with this condition may develop symptoms such as headaches, abdominal pain, or other new symptoms, usually between 4 days and 3 to 4 weeks after the vaccination. Once they come to hospital, we know how to screen for this with a simple blood test, and then we know how to go on to image the patient to look for blood clots.
Authorities insist the risk is extremely low. More than 3.6 million AstraZeneca doses have now been administered across the country. Of the 48 blood clotting cases believed to be linked to the vaccine, 31 people have been discharged from hospital and are recovering, while 15 patients remain in hospital, including one person who's critically ill in intensive care. Professor Hewan Tran, a haematologist who's advised the chief medical officer, says vaccinated Australians who develop possible symptoms should get them checked out as soon as possible.
Even though it's rare, we still need to remind doctors and the community, those who receive the AZ vaccine, of the symptoms associated with each of these clots. It's not to alarm them, but if it's persisting or if it's severe, something that they don't normally have in the past, then they absolutely should go and seek medical attention.
And he says when picked up early, treatments are very effective.
The mainstay of treatment for blood clot is what we call anticoagulants, or in commoner term, blood thinners. And additionally, because we understand that this has an immunological basis to it, we now give what we call intravenous immunoglobulin that can arrest the progression of the blood clot, and that's really helped in the treatment of this condition.
It's haematologist Professor Hewan Tran ending Jade McMillan's report. UK and the US will sign a new Atlantic Charter to replace the World War II Alliance Treaty signed 80 years ago as the G7 gets underway in Cornwall. It's the first overseas visit by Joe Biden since his inauguration, and it comes after his top diplomat in Britain issued a sharp warning to Boris Johnson that he must not let tensions in Northern Ireland spiral out of control. Europe correspondent Linton Besser reports.
Great pleasure, Mr. President, to welcome you to Cornwall.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
Fantastic to see
you. It was all smiles for the cameras as Joe and Jill Biden strolled hand in hand beside British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his new wife, Carrie Simmons.
Everybody is absolutely thrilled to see you.
Thrilled to meet your wife.
Yes, and they thought of to do something else.
They did. I told the Prime Minister we have something in common. Both married way above our
I'm not going to dissent from that one.
The banality's done. A baying British press pack leapt in with customary zeal. What many wanted to ask was about a démarche issued a week ago by the top American diplomat in London, a formal protest usually reserved for adversaries, not allies. According to a report in The Times, it warned the UK that it was putting the Good Friday Agreement at risk At the heart of the issue is Britain's Brexit promise to implement customs checks on goods travelling between Great Britain and Northern Ireland so as to prevent the need for a hard border with Europe. According to the EU, London has failed to keep that promise. Senior Minister Michael Gove tried to play down tensions ahead of the meeting of allies.
There are some details that we do need to resolve in order to ensure that the protocol works effectively, but I know that the European team are committed to working with the UK government to resolve those issues.
But on her way to Cornwall, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen issued a thinly veiled warning that it expects the so-called Northern Ireland Protocol within the Brexit agreement to be respected. If not, Brussels will take action.
We agreed with the United Kingdom that the protocol was the only solution ensuring the absence of a hard border of Northern Ireland. But if not, it is possible to move forward to have remedial measures and a dispute settlement mechanism.
Over coming days, the UK and the US will sign a new post-COVID Atlantic Charter, an ambitious new alliance treaty to replace that signed by Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt. And the G7 meetings will canvass the major geopolitical challenges facing the world, from China's new economic belligerence to the mounting repression of democratic instincts in Russia, to the far bigger and thornier problems posed by a rapidly heating planet. In London, this is Linton Besser reporting for AM.
The Prime Minister Scott Morrison is heading to that G7 meeting. He's had a lightning stop-off in Singapore on the way, meeting PM Lee Hsien Loong. Both are promising to intensify work on a travel bubble, with Mr Morrison declaring he wants the Southeast Asian nation to be the next cab off the rank for quarantine-free travel. But don't dust off your passport just yet. Mr Lee says you'll only give it a green light when a majority of people in both countries have received a COVID-19 vaccine. Here's Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts.
Singapore's Lee Hsien Loong is a veteran statesman. But in this pandemic era, even he looked a little out of practice in front of the cameras while greeting Scott Morrison ahead of a rare face-to-face meeting.
It's been so long since we've done one of these, I've forgotten the truth.
Near the top of the agenda, the travel bubble. Australia already has quarantine-free travel with New Zealand. There's been speculation that Pacific Island nations might be next off the rank. But Mr Morrison has now made it clear he's got his eye on Singapore instead.
Singapore is the first country outside of New Zealand that Australia would wish to engage in a travel bubble with. And we want to get it right.
Lee Hsien Loong is also enthusiastic. Tiny, interconnected Singapore depends on the movement of people, planes and goods in order to thrive.
Before COVID-19, many Singaporeans travelled to Australia for business, for holidays and to pursue their education, and vice versa. And we need to resume these people-to-people flows to maintain our close and excellent bilateral relationship.
But opening the bubble will take time and effort. The first step will be harmonising the rules for travel, including digital certificates which confirm travellers have been vaccinated.
Well, our officials are discussing the air travel bubble and they're also starting to discuss the mutual recognition of health and vaccination certificates. And we will have to resume this in a safe and calibrated manner when both sides are ready.
There is still some time before we reach that milestone, but there is nothing impeding us, as we've discussed today, from getting on with the job of putting systems in place.
But when the systems are in place, both countries will have to make a difficult and complex calculation. When will it be safe enough to take the risk and press go? Neither leader would set firm benchmarks, but Mr. Lee made it clear vaccination rates would be key.
Certainly vaccination rates and transmission rates will be part of the consideration. And I think once the majority of the population is vaccinated, it becomes much easier for us to contemplate these openings up.
And the reality is that while Singapore has already fully vaccinated almost half of its population, a far smaller proportion of Australians have received their jabs. That means it will likely be months before Australian travellers might be able to dream of getting on a plane and jetting to the international travel hub.
Regina Wilson's an Indigenous artist from the Northern Territory whose work is sought all over the world. But this morning, she's talking openly about a wave of violence in her community, which she and other leaders in Pepperminati say is making it unsafe for children to go to school, and some families are keeping their kids home. The leaders are appealing to the Northern Territory Police and government agencies to help make their communities safe, saying a long-running dispute in the community must be brought to an end. Jane Barden reports.
Pepperminati artist Regina Wilson's paintings are renowned around the world, but after months of attacks, she's afraid in her own home. She says a dispute between families in the community dates back 2 years to when her grandson was shot in the chest with an arrow, and in the last 2 months, it's intensified.
14 men came to my house, throwing wheelbrace, axe, whatever, and throwing at my family in the yard.
Regina Wilson says her family have taken 16 children out of school for most of the year.
It is dangerous for our kids to go up to the school. That's why we brought our kids back home and my granddaughter teaching them at home.
27-year-old Dakota Wilson says she's been doing what she can to keep up their lessons.
I had to go into town and buy things for them, like pencil books. We haven't got support from education, not coming to see how the kids are or what's happening with them.
The NT Education Department provided a statement saying it's aware of the community unrest and working with the school to maintain a safe learning environment. Six of the Wilson families have fled their homes, overcrowding relatives' houses. Annunciata Wilson is Regina's daughter.
I had to move out of my house. It was trash and car was burned. Kept on threatening to burn my house down.
She normally runs the night patrol service, but says she's had to scale it back.
Yeah, we was threatened that if they see night patrol patrolling, the bus going to be burnt and smashed, and everybody that's working for night patrol is going to be hurt.
The ABC has also spoken to non-Indigenous workers who say they've had vehicles and premises smashed up and feel unsafe. Regina Wilson says she fears if the violence isn't stopped, they'll leave.
We worried about our staff at art centre, shop, school, nurses. It's not safe for them at night. So we need help, really help from the police to stop the violence.
The NT police haven't yet provided the ABC with a response.
Jane Barden reporting there. In a few weeks, it'll be illegal for companies to export plastic waste from Australia, and we're talking about the unsorted mixed bundles that have no value at all. Industry says it's been investing millions to build the infrastructure to process it here. Some insiders say while the ban's important, it's not fixing another big problem. There are still manufacturers producing tons of packaging that can't be recycled. David Sparks has more.
Old plastic and glass bottles and aluminium cans race along conveyor belts, and huge 400-kilogram bales of the tightly crushed and sorted final product are stacked high.
We receive about 5 million bottles a day. They are then processed into its various commodities like PET, and then they are sent for recycling.
This clean-away facility in Eastern Creek in Sydney's west is where 95% of the bottles collected in the New South Wales Container Deposit Scheme are sorted. Site manager Manoj Prabhu says there are three main types of plastic here.
When someone like me or someone off the street comes and looks at what we're looking at here, we see garbage bundled up. You don't see garbage, do you? You see commodity.
Yes, that is absolute valuable and helpful commodity.
It's an example of how money can be made, jobs created and environmental damage reduced when legislation forces change. And now it's hoped the upcoming bans on exporting plastic waste will have a similar impact. From the 1st of July, unsorted mixed plastics can no longer be shipped overseas. But on July 1st next year, a much tougher ban takes effect, and plastic waste will only be exported if it's been processed into pellets or flakes. Cleanaway's Mark Bidolf says the company is investing more than $100 million on new processing facilities, including plants in Melbourne and Albury, that will turn old plastic into pellets.
The plastic that you sent over will have to be reprocessed. So that's turning it into, say, pellet that can then be exported overseas. So if we export now by polymers, the price goes up. If we export pellets, the price is even higher.
Gail Sloan from the Waste Management and Resource Recovery Association says companies are stepping up, but she sees other flaws in our approach to plastic.
We support the ban. It's absolutely the right intention to actually push remanufacturing onshore in Australia. The bigger issue here, though, is there's a pile of plastic that's coming to market from generators that needs to be designed out that there'll never be a market for.
Gail Sloan says companies that make the packaging we see every day at the supermarkets and in other shops are making it from plastic types that can't be recycled.
Those companies that use low-value plastics that end up in those mixed plastic bales that are not recyclable technically or theoretically anywhere in Australia or overseas. So we need to stop either buying it or making it.
She points the finger squarely at the Australian Packaging Covenant Organisation, which represents packaging manufacturers and retailers. But APCO's Chief Executive Brooke Donnelly says the situation is improving and companies in that sector are serious about meeting new, more ambitious targets.
It can't happen at a single organisational level, and this is the actual really powerful thing about bringing together across the whole supply chain, plastic supply chain, a bunch of different organisations to work on common problems.
The Assistant Minister for Waste Reduction, Trevor Evans, says exports of plastic waste have fallen by 5,000 tonnes a month since the bans were announced.
David Sparks reporting. If you've ever dropped your phone in a puddle or smashed the screen, you'll know it's not always easy to get it fixed. A report from the Productivity Commission published today has found as technology becomes more sophisticated and manufacturers more protective of their software, it's becoming harder to have things repaired. But the Commission says that shouldn't be the case, that a change to copyright laws is needed to give consumers the right to repair. Bridget Fitzgerald prepared this report.
At the back of this shop in Victoria Park in Perth, Farhan is performing surgery on a smartphone.
I have to check the battery and also I have to check the charger board first before I do anything.
Because the brand of phone he's working on doesn't supply spare parts, he's going to have to use so-called aftermarket parts, close to but not quite the real thing. His colleague, Gaurav Dodani, says whether you can get genuine parts depends on the manufacturer.
If you drop your phone and smash the screen, in terms of getting an absolutely original screen, you'd have to go back to the manufacturer for Apple. Samsung, however, are a bit better. They do actually sell service packs. So service packs, I can actually show you one. They have all the bits and bobs. That's the front camera piece, that's an ear speaker, that's a battery in there, and all the little flexin pieces are all here.
A draft report from the Productivity Commission has found things like manufacturers refusing to sell spare parts makes it harder and more costly for consumers to get things fixed, and they may often feel pressured to spend more just to replace the whole thing. It's proposing changes to legislation to better protect consumers. Commissioner Julie Abramson is one of the report authors.
For some consumers, that can be quite a considerable outlay on a product. If you've put in a new fridge or an oven or something that's actually in your premises and you want to get it repaired, we'd like to make that easier.
She says there are particular problems with agricultural machinery, mobile phones and tablets.
We think it's everything from providing some more guidance with the help of the ACCC around what durability of products are and issues such as availability of spare parts and even processes and issues under the copyright law, which might make it easier to get the information that you need to repair a product.
Gaurav Dodani says independent repairers can get into trouble if they're seen to be breaching copyright.
I can't comment exactly for our store, but I've heard of other cases where certain Apple legal team representatives have come to certain stores and checked whether or not they're selling like Apple certified products.
He says it's fair enough for brands to protect their technology, but there should at least be an option for consumers to pay a bit more for the real deal.
If they provided them, we would definitely offer them.
Mm.
Yeah, absolutely.
It just would then give the consumer choice.
Precisely. Yeah. And that's should be what it's about, really.
The Productivity Commission Right to Repair report is now open for submissions before a final report is handed to the federal government in October.
Bridget Fitzgerald reporting. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Scott Mitchell, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. Women behave a bit differently online to men. That's according to one of the biggest social surveys that happens in this country, Australia Talks, run by Vox Pop Labs in conjunction with the ABC. So why is that?
Today on The Signal, from organising boycotts and campaigns to withdrawing their support for public figures and products, we take a look at why Australian women are taking action online more often than men. Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.